41. "Damn nice scenery," Murphy noted, glancing out the window. "Like Alaska on steroids." Gert was watching the altitude gauge as they climbed higher toward the imposing ridge of mountains just ahead. The sun had yet to peek over the horizon, but her coming was heralded by the pink glow being cast over the rugged terrain.
"We could probably claim the helicopter altitude record," Gert said.
"I don't think so," Murphy said. "Some guy went to 24,000 feet a couple of years ago to perform a Himalayan rescue."
"I read about that," Gert said. "But that was in a Bell 206, and it had special rotor blades."
"You sound a little worried," Murphy said.
"Not worried," Gert said. "Just apprehensive."
He pointed out the front windshield at the wall approaching. The trees were petering out as they drew nearer. Now there was only the black and gray of rocks, streaked with tendrils of snow and ice that dripped down the sides of the imposing mountain like rivulets of ice cream on a child's hand. A gust of wind buffeted the helicopter, blowing it sideways. Clouds started to appear around the bell. Gert stared at the gauge again. It read 18,000 feet and climbing. The helicopter carrying Rise, King, and the Dungar forces came in 20 feet above the ground and approached Lhasa from the south. The sound from the Lhasa River helped cover the noise as the pilot landed on a small spit of sand in the river just east of what the Chinese referred to as Dream Island, formerly an idyllic picnic spot now replaced by tacky Chinese shops and karaoke bars.
"Unload the crates!" Rise shouted to the Dungar.
As soon as the crates were unloaded and King had exited, they all raced a short distance away and crouched down to avoid the blast of sand from the rotor wash as the helicopter quickly lifted off and raced downriver. Once the helicopter was out of sound and sight, Rise opened a small satchel and removed a parabolic dish for listening. Quickly switching it on, he listened for the sound of alarms in the city. He heard only the sound of the river. Nodding, he whispered to one of the Tibetans,
"Look."
Prying a crate open, he pointed. It was a box of Tibetan flags, which had long ago been banned by the Chinese oppressors. The flags featured a snow lion with red and blue rays. The man bent down and touched the pile gingerly, and when he rose to look at Rise, his eyes were filled with tears.
"We need to carry all these crates across the river," Rise said to the Tibetan, "and stash them. Then you and the others need to follow me and King to Zurin's house."
"Yes," the Tibetan said eagerly.
"We'll need one of you to guard the flags and one man to go with Mr. King. The other two of you," Rise said quietly, "will enter the house with me."
The Tibetan nodded, then began to whisper orders to his men. 5 minutes later, they were all safely across the river and walking toward the Barkor area of Lhasa. King and his Tibetan helper peeled away from the group and made their way to the tallest building near the home of the Chinese government official. The streets were empty except for a few Tibetan merchants who were sweeping the square in preparation of setting up shop. Taking the steps two at a time, King and his helper made their way to the rooftop where they took up position. Once he was in place, King reached into his bag, removed a small bottle of oxygen, and then took a few deep breaths. He then offered the bottle to the Tibetan, who smiled but shook his head no. Then he scanned the area through his scope. The home of Legchog Zurin was an ornate affair, whose front faced south onto Barkor Square. Just to the east of the house lay the Jokhang, a temple built sometime in the 17th century. The Jokhang, the most revered religious building in Lhasa, featured dozens of statues, a variety of gold artwork, and some 30 chapels. King watched as Rise passed in front of the Jokhang. He stopped for a second and raised a closed fist into the air. Then Rise, followed by two Tibetans, made his way down an alley between the temple and the chairman's house and passed out of view. King pushed the button on a silver-plated stopwatch, set the time for 1 minute, and watched. When the stopwatch read 15 seconds, King reached into his satchel and removed a hollowed-out ram's horn and handed it to the Tibetan.
"When I say," he told him, "start blowing, and don't stop until I tell you to or we're dead."
The man nodded eagerly and took the horn. King took another breath of oxygen and checked the stopwatch. 5 seconds. He glanced at the guards patrolling the walkway outside Zurin's house. There were two outside the wrought iron gate, two more just outside the front door, sitting on chairs.
he lined up his shots.
"Now!" he said loudly.
The horn erupted with the sound of a cat under a vacuum cleaner. Like wraiths appearing above a graveyard, the square was suddenly filled with 4 dozen Dunkar warriors. They had posed as shopkeepers and early morning walkers, and had hidden inside drums containing spices and seeds. They screamed war cries and raced toward the gate leading up to the chairman's home. On the front porch, one of the guards was rousted from a half-sleep by the sound of the horn and the approaching horde. He stood up and reached for a bell near the front door, but before he could reach it to sound the alarm, he heard a sharp crack. As if in a dream, he stared in amazement as his hand and arm from the elbow dropped onto the porch. Then he screamed as blood erupted from the stump like a geyser. At the same time, the Dunkar reached the pair of guards outside the gate. They were dead before they could comprehend what was happening. Their throats slit like pigs at slaughter. Swiveling around, the front door guard stared in horror at the advancing Dunkar. His partner started to speak, but a second later his head was blown off his shoulders. It landed on the porch with a thud, the lips still straining to answer a signal from an impulse now dead. The first Dunkar raced up the steps with his sword held in front. The guard tried to reach for his handgun, but with no hand, he had no chance. The sword ran through his middle and pinned him to the wooden door like some macabre Christmas wreath. He mouthed a few words before dying, but only blood seeped from inside. The force of the guard slamming into the door burst the lock. The door swung open, and the Dunkar raced inside. Around the rear of the house, the scene was less violent. The single guard at the door off the kitchen had been asleep. His dereliction of duty would save his life. Rise crept up, hit him with a stun gun, then had one of the Tibetans bind his mouth, wrists, and legs with duct tape before he had a chance to do anything. Then Rise popped open the lock with a pick and made his way inside. He and the Tibetans were halfway up the stairs leading to Zurin's bedroom before the horn sounded. Then Rise saw them. There were 3 unarmed men at the top of the landing. He reached for his holstered .40-caliber handgun, but before he could snap off a round, a Tibetan houseboy appeared from behind and lopped a leather garrote over the men's heads and pulled tight. Their heads slammed together, then their legs began to kick as the houseboy tightened the cord. Rise motioned for one of the men following to help, then raced past Azurin's door. Stopping for a second to line himself up, he slammed his polished black boot at a point just above the doorknob. The door burst open, and he stepped inside. The man in the bed slowly started to rise while rubbing his eyes, then he reached toward the nightstand. Rise fired a round into the headboard above the man's head, and the room filled with the smell of spent gunpowder.
"I wouldn't," Rise said, "if I were you."
"I can't see much,"
Gert admitted. The clouds had closed in as they neared the top of the pass. Snow and sleet raked across the windshield of the bell. The 212 was slowly ascending, but barely making any forward movement at all. They were flying blind on the edge of the helicopter's performance envelope.
"I've got a road," Murphy suddenly shouted, "on the port side."
Gert spotted the black stripe against the white background. A movement of vehicles across the terrain had displaced most of the snow, leaving only dirt and rock.
"What's that?"
Gert said, straining to see.
"I think it's a column of tanks," Murphy said.
"I'll go to one side," Gert said, "and stay in the cloud cover."
Along the side of the road, a Chinese tank commander was watching several of his soldiers repair a tread that had come loose. He heard the helicopter in the distance, so he climbed inside and called his superior on the radio.
"No idea," his superior reported. "But you'd better find out what it is."
Popping his head out of the hatch, the tank commander shouted down to his men. Then he began to pass rifles out of the hatch. 2 minutes later, the soldiers were hiking up the road away from their disabled tank.
"There's the crest," Murphy shouted. "Find a spot to touch down."
Gert played with the collective, but at this altitude he had little control.
"Hold on," he shouted.
The landing was more a controlled crash than a touchdown. The 212 came down hard on the skids, but they held. Murphy was already unsnapping his safety harness.
"Driver," he said, smiling, "just keep her running. I'll only be a minute."
Opening the door, he stepped out and a few feet back and opened the cargo door. Then he removed a pair of snowshoes, which he attached to his feet. Pulling on another coat over the one he was already wearing, he began to dig in a crate, placing the items he needed into a backpack.
"Hold down the fort," he shouted to the front of the helicopter. "I'm going to set the charges."
Gert nodded, then watched as Murphy disappeared into the blowing snow. Then he began to play with his radio. He found little to hear, so he switched back to the regular frequency.
"Sherpa, Sherpa, Sherpa, this is the Oregon. Over."
In the control room, Eric Stone looked at Hanley with worry. "That's the fifth time. Nothing."
"Sherpa, Sherpa, Sherpa, this is the Oregon. Over."
"Oregon, this is Sherpa,"
Gert answered.
"Read ya, 8x8.
There was a 2-second delay as the signal bounced off the ionosphere and down to the ship.
"Where are you?"
Hanley said, taking the microphone.
"We're on site,"
Gert reported.
"Your man just left for the appointment."
"We've just intercepted a communication from the bad guys," Hanley said. "Someone heard you go over, and they've been asked to investigate."
"This is not good, Oregon,"
Gert said quickly.
"I have no way to reach Murphy and warn him. Plus, it's going to take us some time to lift off."
"Okay," Hanley said. "We can send a signal to Murph's beeper. We'll tell him to return to where you are. In the meantime, keep a close eye for anyone approaching. If they do, you take to the air."
"Send a message to Murphy to withdraw," Hanley said to Stone, who quickly punched the commands into his keyboard.
"My visibility is around 30 to 40 feet,
Gert said.
"And I'm not leaving Murph. No way."
"No, we don't want you to," Hanley started to say.
"Oregon,"
Gert shouted over the radio.
"There are Chinese troops coming through the snow."
Murphy was bent over, placing the charges in the snow, when his beeper chirped. He finished attaching the detonation cord, then rose up and removed the beeper from his pocket.
"Damn,"
he said, flipping the switch open so the charge could be remotely detonated. Then he pulled his M16 around from his back on its sling and began heading back in the direction of the helicopter. Gert reached behind his seat and felt for a handgun in a rack. The Chinese troops were struggling through the thick snow, making slow but steady progress toward the bell. They were holding rifles, but they had yet to take a shot. Murphy stumbled along as fast as one could run on snowshoes. While he ran, he was folding out a grenade launcher. Reaching over his shoulder into the pack, he removed a rocket-propelled grenade and started fitting it into the launcher. He was on a sloping ridge, racing down, when he first caught sight of the Chinese troops. They were 25 feet from the bell. Murphy estimated his angle and fired a grenade. It went over the heads of the Chinese troops and exploded. They flopped on their bellies in the deep snow.
"What the?"
Gert started to say as he turned and saw Murphy approaching in the distance. Adding fuel to the turbine, Gert tried to lift off. Nothing. Murphy was 20 feet away now and racing toward the helicopter. The first few Chinese troops began to rise from the snow and shoulder their rifles. Gert started firing the handgun from the window. A couple seconds later, Murphy's M16 opened up. 10 feet now. Gert reached across and opened the co-pilot's door. Murphy paused in his firing, removed his pack, placed it gingerly behind his seat, and climbed inside, holding the M16 in his lap. Gert was firing the handgun and fiddling with the collective at the same time.
"Morning," Murphy said when there was a moment of quiet. "Anything exciting happening while I was away?"
"We have no lift,"
Gert said before squeezing off a few rounds.
"I'll need to milk the cyclic to get us off the ground."
The Chinese troops had stopped advancing. Now they were digging in to make their kill shot. Murphy slipped between the seats into the rear and yanked open both cargo doors.
"Quit firing and take us up, Gert. I'll handle these boys."
Milking the cyclic is bad for helicopters. It consists of jamming the cyclic from side to side while pumping up and down on the collective. It can create lift when there is none, but it can also easily cause the mast that supports the rotor to bump against other parts of the helicopter. Then you run the risk of a nick or a fracture in the mast. Lose the mast and you've lost the helicopter. The firefight had erupted so quickly that the Chinese tank commander had little time to rally his men. Now that he'd had a few minutes to prepare, and his troops were dug into the snow, he began to shout orders that would concentrate fire in the right direction. Gert slammed the cyclic from one side to the other, and the 212 began to rise slowly. Right at that instant, the Chinese commander screamed for his men to advance, and the front line rose. At the same time, Murphy triggered the grenade, and it left the launcher with a whoosh and a burning smell that filled the cabin. The round landed 6 feet in front of the lead soldier and exploded. Murphy followed that up with a complete clip from the M-16. He replaced the clip and prepared to fire again. Just then, Gert got the Bell off the ground and struggled to turn away from the firefight. They were 100 feet away from the Chinese troops when Murphy blew through the second clip and the bloody snow where the Chinese troops lay began to fade in the distance. He quickly replaced the clip, set the M-16 to one side, and reached for the remote detonator. The C-6 erupted with a force equivalent to 10,000 pounds of TNT. A slab of snow was ripped from the side of the hill and raced down the slope, covering the Chinese troops. Then the slide raced across the road with a wall of snow and ice 20 feet high. In sympathy, smaller slides broke loose from the opposite hillside from the shockwave that trembled through the rock and soil. These slides added another 8 to 10 feet to the mess already created. The few Chinese troops still living after the firefight were buried beneath the wall of snow.